One in four women in the U.S. will have an abortion by age 45. Over the past few weeks, thousands of these women have shared their stories through the You Know Me hashtag as more states have passed restrictions on the procedure. Today, we'll talk about that and the status of the Reproductive Health Act here in Illinois. Plus, what makes a good French fry? Are we thinking about curly waffle fries seasoned? We're going to talk about this with two Chicago food critics and the owner of Black Dog in Champaign, Urbana. And we want to hear what you think. Tell us where your favorite place to get fries is in Illinois. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Perhaps you've heard the news that Missouri could soon become the first state without a single clinic to perform abortions, which would essentially end legal abortion in the state. Missouri is actually one of eight states that have passed restrictive abortion laws since the beginning of the year. But here in Illinois, just yesterday, we're moving in another direction. The state house passed its own legislation called the Reproductive Health Act. Its goal is fundamentally different from the others being passed around the country, and especially around our neighboring states. Here in Illinois, the Reproductive Health Act would ensure the, quote, fundamental right of a pregnant woman to have an abortion. Of course, it isn't just lawmakers who were talking about this. Over the past few weeks, thousands of people have shared their own abortion stories using the hashtag YouKnowMe. We're going to talk about all of this now with Northwestern University bioethicist, lawyer, and author Katie Watson, who's on the line with us now. Hi, Katie. Welcome back to the 21st.
Good morning.
Leslie Regan is also in studio with me here in Urbana. She teaches in the history department at the University of Illinois and studies reproductive history as well. Leslie, thanks for being here, too.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Katie, I wonder if we can start with not maybe the history, but the most recent news. And so we're looking yesterday at the Illinois House passing the Reproductive Health Act. I think some people might be confused, Katie, because maybe they've heard all of the conversation around HB 40, which was a big part of our conversation a couple of years ago. And maybe they thought, well, that kind of protected the right for women to get abortions legally should Roe versus Wade be overturned. Can you share a little specifics of what you understand about the Reproductive Health Act?
Sure. So the Reproductive Health Act undoes abortion in the criminal code of Illinois. And these are old statutes, many of which have been blocked by the courts. So, for example, a spousal consent statute is still on our books, even though courts have blocked it. The idea that women have to go before a committee of doctors to get permission for their abortion, it's been blocked by the courts, but it's still on our books. The 24-hour waiting period, this kind of thing. And the concern is that if Roe were to fall, all those injunctions, is the legal term, could be challenged because they were premised on, hey, this is unconstitutional under Roe. So it takes abortion out of the criminal code, gets rid of all those outdated statutes from 1975, and just converts it to an affirmative statement that says women have a fundamental right to reproductive health care, and that includes maternity care and contraception. And says it's going to be done according to medical practices, and then essentially codifies the Roe standard. I think the simple way to think of it is instead of relying on the Supreme Court to protect the women of Illinois, which we can no longer rely on, the state legislature protects it and creates it as a fundamental right. It also has a provision to require private insurance to cover abortion the same as is covered for other pregnancy-related care, and that's important too.
Right, because that's, as we're thinking about access, health insurance is an important part of the conversation.
You pay your premiums for all your health care.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we can, I want to get into some of the history of this, but before we do that, I am kind of interested in how this debate played out yesterday. Yesterday, on the, and it was a, the House debated on this, and in a kind of an unusual move, Republicans deferred almost all of their time to just one colleague, and that's State Representative Avery Born, who is actually pregnant. She's about, I think, 4 weeks away from giving birth, and she spent 45 minutes debating State Representative Kelly Cassidy, a Democrat from Chicago who is the chief sponsor of this. We're going to play just a minute or so of their conversation here for you all to listen. This part that we're playing starts with Republican Representative Born asking Representative Cassidy about what standards should be used to determine whether an abortion could happen.
Should they be looking at the other children in the household? Should they be looking at the spouse's health? Should they be looking at any of these other factors? How broad do we intend for this to be?
A doctor will make a decision based on the accepted standards of medical care.
Could you give me any parameters that we're asking this doctor to make?
I am not a doctor. Doctors decide. And doctors decide based on the accepted standards of clinical care.
Okay, could you define for me what age would be a factor for this? We're talking about...
That would depend on the accepted standards of medical care.
Again, that's, you just heard, that was Representative Kelly Cassidy. About 45 minutes she spent on the floor debating Representative Born over this issue. Katie, I wonder, just to hear where Representative Cassidy was saying this should depend on doctors, I wonder from a legal perspective, how much have lawmakers allowed this decision to be made in a medical realm versus the legal realm?
Well, so for 46 years, Illinois and other states have been governed by Roe and its companion case, Doe versus Bolton, which sets out, that allows states, doesn't require them, but allows them to ban abortion after viability, except in the case of the life and the health of the pregnant person is threatened, and gave a very a deferential standard that said that will be for physicians to decide when they are in that territory. So the Supreme Court staked it out that way, knowing that medical treatments change, every pregnancy is different. And so Illinois is capturing that. And so I can hear some people, I can imagine someone saying what Representative Cassidy said. It's frustrating. She's saying accepted standards of medical care. But I think her point there is legislators need to get out of the pretend medical business and making up scenarios and, okay, we're going to codify abortion in condition X and situation Y with detail Z and say, these are always changing. They're very nuanced decisions. And as the Supreme Court has for 46 years, we're going to leave them to physicians and their patients in these this very small number of cases that could fit into that exception. And it is very small. There's nothing in the RHA that would create a different standard than the entire country has been living under for 46 years. So the scare tactics of Representative Born and others to suggest there's going to be these cases that we would all agree were just too much, it's a witch hunt.
That's Katie Watson. She's the author of Scarlet A, The Ethics, Law, and Politics of Ordinary Abortion, on the line with us from Chicago, where she teaches at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Leslie Regan is in studio with me here in Urbana. She's at U of I's History Department. She's the author of Dangerous Pregnancies, Mothers, Disabilities, and Abortion in Modern America. And Leslie, I wonder, now that we kind of understand a little bit of the modern context, if you can put some of the historical context around this. Katie mentioned the Illinois abortion law of 1975. When we look back to Illinois' history, how long has Illinois been seen maybe differently from other states as a haven for reproductive rights when it comes to issues like abortion?
Yeah, well, Illinois' first laws criminalizing abortion from conception on were passed in 1867. And I think a lot of people don't understand that in the first place, that it
This is a long history of, right.
Yeah, it's a long history of it being illegal a whole century from 1867 to the Supreme Court decision in 1973. But also prior to that time, it was legal in early America under common law until quickening, when the woman felt the movement of the fetus. And that's often not understood. We sort of have an assumption that it was always illegal, always condemned, and maybe nobody did it until the sexual revolution of the 1960s. And that's something that's completely incorrect. In fact, abortion was commonly used and practiced, even when it was illegal. And Chicago was a known place for people to come for abortions. And
this is pre-Roe versus Wade.
Before Roe versus Wade, in the 1900s, the 1930s, there were open practitioners in the 1930s and 40s, and women traveled in by trains from Wisconsin, Iowa, Indiana, as well as from rural areas into Chicago to very safe practitioners until there were police crackdowns.
And so it was actually illegal, but there were safe, obviously this wasn't being enforced because there were doctors who were offering this.
Yes, it was illegal and there were safe clinics where it was open. There were also unsafe practitioners and there were people who, you know, there were many women who did their own abortions. And sometimes that was very unsafe and they landed in hospitals and there were deaths. So there was a mix. And that's what happens when you have illegal abortion. You have a mixture of both safety and very dangerous conditions.
So then we would look at Illinois' history. Katie, I wonder if we can look at our more recent history. And as we think about, we started this conversation by talking about how Missouri could be the first state to not have a clinic to perform abortions. If its last Planned Parenthood clinic closes, that's actually in St. Louis. And we've seen and we've had conversations on this program about how many people have been traveling to Illinois to have abortions because particularly from the St. Louis area, from Indiana. What are, when we look at numbers overall, I think the numbers for abortions are going down in this country, but the numbers being performed in Illinois, Katie, correct me if I'm wrong, are a little higher because of women coming from neighboring states?
Yes. Yeah, so I don't have the number right in front of me, but I think it's approximately 14% of our patients in Illinois are from out of state. And that should really shock us if 14% of our, you know, knee replacement patients or our children getting immunizations or our, you know, fill in the blank healthcare were from out of state, we'd say those neighboring states are having a healthcare crisis. Why do people have to come to Illinois for healthcare? So we do already have people traveling across the border. We can only expect that will increase. So for example, St. Louis is right on the border. And then there is a clinic called Hope Clinic that is in Granite City, Illinois, that's very close to the Missouri border, I have to imagine they will be flooded and other neighboring states where there is access. So if these laws will go to court and be enjoined, so it's really important to say abortion is still governed. The law is still Roe and Casey. And so when these states pass these bans, lawsuits happen and they are blocked by the courts typically. Missouri is unique, or not unique, but in this case, the twist is it, in addition to passing a very restrictive law that will be challenged, it's got the 8-week ban, but it's doing something enforcing outdated health regulations that it's never enforced before. So odd things about the number of pelvic exams someone has to have and that kind of thing. And that's what's leading to the potentially immediate closure of that clinic. So that's a trickier thing to wrangle with in the regulatory world.
Katie, you mentioned the 8-week ban. I know there's a lot of different language around abortion that sometimes is not understood. What is that?
So the Supreme Court 46 years ago said before viability, which is when a fetus has a reasonable chance of survival outside of the womb, states may not ban abortion. And in a healthy pregnancy, the medical profession has decided that's around 24 weeks. Now, at 24 weeks, if you delivered prematurely, that's 60-something percent of those deliveries survive to discharge. It doesn't mean there's a guaranteed chance of survival, but it means there's a reasonable chance of survival. So that's been the standard. The 8-week ban says, oh, we're going to completely ignore Roe and set a standard that says 8 weeks after your last period, which for most people would be 6 weeks of pregnancy, abortion will be a crime after that. So for many women, that's before they know they're pregnant. It certainly violates Roe. And for many women, it violates their own moral and religious perspective on when terminating a pregnancy is morally acceptable to them and their doctor. So it imposes the legislature's moral vision on women and physicians at earlier and earlier stages. And we have other states that are doing this at closer to 6 weeks. And of course, Alabama has just passed an outright ban saying there's no abortion that's permissible.
And how much of that is designed, Katie, to be a legal challenge to Roe versus Wade?
100% is designed to be a legal challenge. There'd be no point in passing these laws, although they, you know, in the past, things have been passed as just symbolic gestures. They allowed legislators to vote on laws that will never become law so they could be on record as saying how pro-life they are, quote unquote. But in this moment, the flurry of legislation is intended to provide test cases for the to invite, they're all invitations to the Supreme Court to invite them to revisit Roe and Casey and chip away at that fundamental right. And the strategy being, well, you picked the viability line 46 years ago. What about a little glimmer of embryonic cardiac activity? Isn't that, couldn't the states pick that? And so that's the strategy right now, is could we move the line? Alabama's the most radical, saying, hey, just overturn Roe entirely, hand it back to the states.
Right, but Kate, it's really looking at the philosophy, the legal philosophy behind this as well, it seems like. Leslie, can I ask you, as you research the history, as you research the history of this as a historian, what clues could we take from history in terms of what could happen to women seeking abortions if Roe versus Wade were ever to be overturned?
Well, we have a history and we know what will happen when it's illegal. Well, we have good clues. For one, the laws, whether or not they explicitly say that the women, the people who have abortions will be included and be prosecuted, which the laws did say that in the past, will be hurt and will be punished and arrested and prosecuted as part of this. The results of criminalization meant injuries, meant deaths. When it was illegal by the 1960s, we had thousands of women coming into emergency rooms across the country, almost 5,000 women a year coming into Cook County Hospital in Chicago, bleeding, injured, and some of them dying. We do not have a separate ward for septic abortion cases at Cook County Hospital anymore. So that's the kind of thing that happened. Police and prosecutors went after abortionists and raided the clinics, arrested women there and brought them in, did forced gynecological examinations.
I'm sorry, we have to take a break here, but we will continue this conversation on the other side of this. That's Leslie Regan with U of I. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about different abortion legislation across the country. Yesterday here in Illinois, the State House passed its own legislation called the Reproductive Health Act. If approved by the Senate, it would ensure the, quote, fundamental right of a pregnant woman to have an abortion in Illinois. Keep in mind, our legislative session ends this Friday, so we'll be keeping an eye on that. We've been speaking about this with Kitty Watson. She's a bioethicist, lawyer, and author based at Northwestern University. Leslie Regan is also in studio with me here in Urbana. She teaches. She's a professor in the history department at the U of I. Katie, I wanted to ask you about, as we've been talking about the laws, and I wonder if we can shift our conversation a little bit, because just looking at, we were just talking about how common abortion was before it was legalized. Today, how common is abortion here in the U.S., Katie?
So as you mentioned, rates are dropping. And so at the last time data was gathered, abortion rates were the lowest that they'd been in the United States since Roe versus Wade was decided. And still, it was almost a million abortions a year. And if that rate continued, what that means is every woman currently of reproductive age between 15 and 44, one in four of us would be expected to have an abortion before menopause. One in four American women, if the rates stayed the same. So it's the lowest, the rates are the lowest they've been since Roe. And still, one in four American women expected to have an abortion by menopause. So one thing when I put on my clinical bioethics hat is, we say we're very conflicted about abortion. But what another version of that statistic is, 42% of unintended pregnancies women choose to end with abortion. And so we can look at opinion polls and we can look at voting, but then let's also look at behavior and patient choices and pregnant people's choices. And it turns out 19% of all American pregnancies end in abortion each year. So it's actually an incredibly common procedure. And as Professor Reagan just eliminated, it was a common procedure when it was illegal. The difference is, is it going to be common and safe or common and unsafe? Mm. And for people who are concerned about gestational age, I hate to use the word irony, but if you ban it, of course that makes it more difficult and time consuming for people to find a provider. So it pushes those million abortions to later dates. So even if they are finding safe providers, which they will find sometimes even in illegal circumstances, it's often at later gestational ages than it would have been if it were legal and accessible and they could just look it up in the phone book and have it covered by their insurance.
Katie, so can I ask you about, so your point being that abortion is ordinary, which is the title of your book, but I wanted to ask you about the conversation that has been happening in social media. There's been this hashtag called You Know Me. I wonder if you can explain for people who haven't seen it what women are doing with these stories that they're sharing.
It's so fascinating. Abortion has been, people who have abortions are silenced by stigma. They don't want to talk about it typically. And this hashtag, You Know Me, was started by a celebrity named Busy Phillips who had a talk show and who in reaction to the, I believe the Alabama ban, shared on her talk show that she had an abortion when she was 15. And she said, you know, people say, I don't know anyone who's had an abortion, but you know me. And then that launched that hashtag. And people have been sharing their stories, which I think is very powerful. I'd like to add one related note. In Springfield today, there are two legislators from Georgia and one from Missouri who are here talking to Illinois senators, giving their legislative version of You Know Me, which is, I'm a legislator who watched my colleagues chip away at abortion rights, and I kept thinking it'll never get that bad. And then we landed on a ban. In Illinois, you have an opportunity I only wish we had years ago to just say we're not going to mess with this anymore. So they're almost doing their own legislative version of look what happened to us in these states. And so I think patients putting their stories forward is very powerful. And today we're seeing legislators from other states come say, don't let this happen to you.
Yeah. Look, Leslie, I wonder if we think about that just as we end here, I wonder how you see this different historically, because from a historian's viewpoint of this, abortions have been happening for centuries and will continue to happen. But do you see a significant difference in the way we're talking about it, especially in the past couple of weeks?
This is so important that women are saying, you know me, that they have had abortions. There's also a movement among young women wearing T-shirts saying, I have had an abortion, and telling stories and coming out with their stories.
Why do you think this is important?
Because it is about destigmatizing this history and insisting that it's acceptable, it's morally acceptable, it cannot be a secret, and that it needs to be open and legal. And it's making it illegal is about safety, and it is also about stigmatizing women for doing something that has been morally acceptable in the past among Americans. And I think it helps women and people to know this, that they are not alone. It is not new. This is generations of women, and their grandmothers have been doing this. They talk to each other. They talk to their sisters, their mothers, sometimes their boyfriends and husbands if they were going to be in agreement. And this is what can change the law and save legal abortion and save safety for women and men and sexual freedom and reproductive rights.
Katie, I imagine you agree with Leslie to the point of having conversations about this. Certainly you found in your research that most women who have abortions, their partner is aware of that and part of the decision.
Mm-hmm. That's research done by the Guttmacher Institute that I cite in my book, that a very high percentage of women having abortions are discussing this with their partner and they're making joint decisions. And that's what you would imagine of functional couples. I think it's 86% of women having abortions are married to or dating the person with whom they became pregnant. And the same shared values that brought them together and potentially shared life goals are the ones that lead them to have conversations about what to do next and what, how do we fit this unintended pregnancy into our life or what's our next step. So that's common decision making. So to me, the Reproductive Health Act in Illinois, I'd almost call it the Family Privacy Act. But on the flip of that, there's the number of women and couples who go forward with unintended pregnancies and say, this is what's right for me and fits my moral framework. I need to continue this pregnancy, that we support them as well. So that it lets everyone have that privacy to move forward. But the conversation, as Leslie said, is so important to normalize these decisions. You don't need to approve of them. The question is, what do you want to do in your own life, and who can you talk to when it's time to think that through?
That's Katie Watson, who is at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Leslie, you wanted to add one last point?
Well, I just wanted to say that silence is what keeps stigma and allows these kinds of attacks on reproductive rights. And we know from the gay rights movement the same thing, that people coming out, talking about love and marriage really changed laws and changed people's understanding. And these are related. The women's abortion rights and reproductive justice movements and gay rights are very similar. The more people talk and come out, that people find out, oh, I have friends who've had abortions. I have a sister. I have, in fact, you know, men. Oh, there's lots of men who've been involved with abortion. And we can't have this pretense that it doesn't exist, that it's not part of our lives and our history and the people we know and love, and that there's real reasons for it. And that we also have to be compassionate and accept that we're not all the same. We don't all have the same beliefs, but the law has to accept this.
That's Leslie Regan, who teaches at in the history department at the University of Illinois. I want to thank Katie Watson for being with us as well. As we mentioned, we're keeping an eye on the State House and what happens. Lawmakers have until Friday to make a decision on this, so we'll keep you informed here on the 21st. Katie, Leslie, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When people order fries, they act like it's a little adventure. They'll be like, should we get a plate of fries for the table? Should we do it? Should we share some fries? They gotta make sure that everyone's on board with it. It's like, if I get fries, you'll have a couple, right? If I get fries for the table, I know you'll have fries if I get fries. Should we do it? Yeah, let's be bad. Come on, let's do it. All right, we're gonna take a plate of fries. It's like a group of couples agreeing to do ecstasy together.
That's, of course, comedian and Chicago native John Mulaney on Comedy Central. Whether you like your fries curly, waffled, seasoned, or original, it's hard to resist a great French fry. But where are the best? And what makes a great fry? We've been talking about this with you on social media. Josh in Decatur told us on Facebook he likes a good crinkle cut. Quote, you get maximum surface area, so you have the perfect balance of crispy outside and soft, warm inside. They also retain heat better than a straight cut fry. We know people have a lot of opinions about this. If you take your fries as seriously as that, we would love to hear from you. The number to join us is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Louisa Chu and Nick Kindlesberger have been out in search of the best fries in the Chicago region. In fact, they tried more than 100 places, and they're on the line with us now. All in service of Chicago Tribune readers. Hi, Louisa. Hi, Nick. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Nyla.
Here with me in studio is Mike Cochran, who's the owner of Black Dog, a smoke and ale house in Champaign and Urbana. Hi, Mike. Thanks for being here as well.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And it smells so delicious in here, because I wish our listeners could smell what I'm smelling in here, which is lots of different sauces and fries that you brought, right?
Yeah, I brought... our sauce flight, which is eight of our house-made barbecue sauces, which a lot of people dip their fries in instead of ketchup. And then I made a version of fry sauce with a couple of our barbecue sauces and one with one of our house-made hot sauces.
Can you tell me what fry sauce is? I think some people may not be familiar with this concept.
I wasn't aware it was a real thing until I started looking it up, but it is where it's basically two parts mayonnaise, usually mixed with one part ketchup. As we like to do, since we like our sauces and we like to make different things, I've just replaced that with our house sauce, one part that, two parts mayo.
Okay.
It's delicious.
Louisa, I'm sure you have thoughts on fry sauce.
I do have thoughts on fry sauce. So I've had the, what I think is the original fry sauce that is in Salt Lake City in Utah. And you pretty much described exactly what the flavors are like, kind of like a ketchup-y mayonnaise. And maybe sometimes people get a little adventurous. They might throw like a little tiny bit of chopped up relish in there too.
Okay. And so you brought, Mike, you have sweet potato fries here.
Yes.
Mm. Okay. Which one do you want me to try first here?
Well, maybe we should try the sweet potato
fries.
Yeah,
okay.
With the fry sauce.
Right.
This is the Georgia peach sauce, which is our milder sauce.
Oh, yeah, I love Georgia. Okay, this is, okay. Okay, so I'm trying the Georgia peach fry sauce. Oh, that's good. Well, that's interesting because you get the, sorry, people, I know this is going to cause a lot of contention when I'm chewing on the air. I know people do not like this. I will move away from the microphone.
I like it, for the record.
So the Georgia peach sauce is one of my, I have to say, it's one of my favorite sauces that you guys have, Mike. It's because it's got that nice tang to it. And it's I like it because it has that tang and not really, I don't know if it has heat. Does it have heat a little bit?
Very little heat. There's just a dash of
cayenne. But it's really nice to go with mayo as opposed to, Louisa, is original fry sauce maybe sweeter because it's mayonnaise and ketchup and relish? That seems pretty sweet to me.
A tiny bit. Like I said, people who get a little adventurous in the Salt Lake City area and the fry sauce purists are, dare I say it, not that adventurous. It's kind of like a mild ketchup-y mayo. It's fine. It's an inoffensive, adventurous sauce for people who might go crazy and get a plate of fries for the table to share.
Right. Nick, can you tell us about your list here? I'm going to keep eating sweet potato fries and talking here. But Nick, can you tell us about what the parameters were for your list? Did you do sweet potato fries?
We definitely did not do sweet potato fries. So when someone suggested we find the best French fries in Chicago, my mind just couldn't process all that information because basically every restaurant in Chicago serves fries. So we would be still eating fries right now and for probably the next 2 or 3 years if we were going to try all the fries in Chicago. So we set some pretty strict limitations. One of those was that we were only going to do sort of classic French fries. So no.
What's a classic French fry? Oh, no waffle fries. Okay.
No waffle fries. So we're just talking about the stick, you know, the straight-sided stick. I think we considered crinkle cut, but we also, the big thing was that they had to be hand cut or fresh cut fries. So these are fries that were whole potatoes, or there's this machine that you sort of crank the whole potato through, and it slices the whole potato into all the fries right there in the restaurant. So no frozen fries were considered. And then the last limitation was that it had to be under $5. And you might say, who charges more than $5 for French fries?
In Chicago, there would be a lot of people, I imagine.
A lot of people did. So this was great because this knocked out a lot of the sort of fancier restaurants, which was arguably pretty good because, you know, those restaurants, they have so many other things they're focusing on. We really wanted to focus on the restaurants and stands that put a lot of effort into their French fries.
Okay. We've been talking to you on Facebook about this. If you have, we would love to hear from you. All of the people who are listening all across the state, tell us where your favorite place to get fries is in your town. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Annika on Chicago's West Side said, if the fries are thin, they have to be crispy. And if they're thick, they have to be well-seasoned or have a really good dipping sauce. Mike, can I ask you how you make your fries at Black Dog?
Well,
is that a
secret? Afraid, no. I was afraid that was going to come up, but these are regrettably frozen French fries.
Oh,
we do not hand cut our fries.
How labor intensive would that process be?
It was less the labor and more that we lacked space when we opened our Urbana restaurant, and we just had to make choices.
Okay, we're going to continue this conversation in just a few minutes on the 21st. Stay tuned.
There are several sacred things in this world that you don't ever mess with. One of them happens to be another man's fries. Now you remember that, and you'll live a long and healthy life.
You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and that's a clip from the movie Men at Work, reminding us of an important life lesson, which is hands off my fries. We're talking about this with Louisa Chu and Nick Kindlesberger from the Chicago Tribune Food and Dining section. They had the big sacrifice of trying more than 100 different places across the Chicagoland area to find the best fries. In studio with me, Mike Cochran is here from Black Dog Smoke and Ale in Champaign and Urbana. I've been having his sweet potato fries with blue cheese dressing. He's got a couple other sauces I want to get to in a second. But Louisa, we haven't talked about your favorites. Can we start with Jimmy's Red Hots?
Yeah. You know, at first I wanted to mention really quick that I am not totally against frozen fries either. You know, what Nick and I have this conversation actually fight sometimes. There's a certain kind that are kind of like almost coated with like a crispy seasoning. I like those. And also that it was a team effort. None other than our food editor, Joe Gray, did try crinkle cut, fresh cut fries at Superdog. They just did not make our final 20 cut because it was a fierce field. And as you mentioned, Jimmy's Red Hots is one of the oldest hot dog stands in the Chicago area. They say it's the oldest in the same location. And so their fries were the very first fries I think I ever had because I grew up about a block away. Theirs are almost as if you took a potato and somehow like laser cut it into French fry form, and it falls apart into slightly crisp, almost kind of softer, some might say soggier kind of French fries, but like so incredibly filled with potato flavor. And then Nick and I had to make this distinction between like, is it like mashed potato, baked potato? What kind of potato flavor is this? And I think that we thought this was almost closer to like baked potato flavor. And what's really amazing is that they use all different kinds of fries. If you've ever been there, you'll know that they use like whatever kind of bags they end up getting extra somewhere. And so they end up actually getting different kinds of potatoes on whatever is the best kind of deal. And yet how somehow they're able to turn out consistently amazing, wonderful fries. And those were actually our number 3 in our top 20 of French fries, best French fries in the Chicagoland area.
Was Jimmy's Red Hots.
Jimmy's Red Hots.
Louisa, this is why you are a food and dining reporter, because you describe the consistency of a potato as being more mashed potatoes, where I would just use the word mealy, but I love that you use mashed potatoes instead of...
We thought the Jimmy's ones, I think, Nick, were more baked potato. Other ones were like mashed potatoes, some almost like those silky, buttery Robuchon pomme puree. So when you taste over like 100 different kinds of French fries, you start making fine distinctions.
Nick, do you have a favorite on the list, or which one would you pick?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that our number one pick is the best. This was Mr. D's Shish Kebabs. So this place just takes frying fries to a whole level of obsessiveness that is just mind-boggling. They don't buy just any potato. They buy these enormous steakhouse potatoes that are like a foot long. And so when they cut them through the thing, the fries are very long. And they're fried once at a lower temperature and then at a higher temperature. And when they're handled so delicately through the whole process. So when they present them to you, they're all lined up perfectly parallel to each other and then handed over to you and sold for, what did we say, Louisa? What were they sold for?
$1.85.
Right. That's a pretty good deal. $1.85.
Yeah. I would put these fries up against almost anything you would find downtown at an expensive restaurant. They have a very light coating, like not a super crunchy coating, though they are crisp. And then on the inside, I think these are more like mashed potatoes, which is that creamy, sort of very soft and luscious potato flavor. I think they're quite possibly perfect French fries.
That's Nick Kindlesberger with the Chicago Tribune. Louisa Chu is also with us. Louisa, Nick tried all of these fries. They've got their top 20 list that we will tweet out. We're asking you, speaking of Twitter, Scott says on Twitter says his favorite fries are crispy. On Facebook, Wendy from Urbana says sweet potato fries with goat cheese dip at Uncommon Ground in Chicago are her favorite. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Speaking of sweet potato fries, Mike is in studio with me here from Black Dog Smoke and Ale. And Mike, I wanted to get to you. You have your, this is actually my favorite combination of you guys is sweet potato fries, which is your blue cheese dressing.
Oh, right. The blue cheese dressing is something that we make in-house. We actually smoke wheels of blue cheese, and then we make the dressing from scratch.
Ah, it's delicious. So this is why I've never been able to replicate this at home, obviously. Why did you come up with blue cheese dressing with sweet potato fries? Because I feel like that's kind of a little unusual maybe, right?
Well, that's where the collaboration comes in. I don't know that I ever thought of it, but since we had both things on the menu, I think people gravitated towards that.
And you made a couple of other sauces here. So is this you made in terms of fry sauces, this is a habanero sauce?
Yeah.
This is your hottest sauce?
Yes.
And so do you feel like, I wonder what you think about the heat, mayo combination.
I tend to like things a little on the spicy side. This was something that I learned when I was back before I owned the Black Dog and I was a bartender. We would take Cholula sauce and mix it with mayo for just a new kind of fry dip. And that was just something that I don't know how that came about, but just something we did.
That's nice that heat stays with you. I still have the habanero, but the mayo really cuts that really well. Nick, when you were talking about Mr. D's, maybe not in the fancy fry category, but Small Cheval, I imagine, is in the fancy fry category, right?
But they were still under $5. So this is, that was how they qualified for this. And, it's not, this is the sister restaurant to Au Cheval, which is in the West Loop and always has a 3-hour line to get in. Small Cheval is much more approachable, and yet you still get these like really wonderful golden colored fries. So these are sort of on the lighter side of the color spectrum of some Chicago's. I would say like Red Hot Ranch is more of a darker brown, but these are just a really beautiful golden color and all very consistently done.
So I think people have a preference about soggy fries or not, crispy, soggy. Louisa, you mentioned Robuchon. I want to go back to that and you can explain it. But Nick, do you think soggy, there are people who like soggy fries or you think no?
So this was something I used to think that the only good French fry was a crispy French fry. And I have changed my mind over the years. I think that the best French fry tastes the most like potatoes. And there is a delicate balance between being too meat. When you're too crispy, it sort of lessens the flavor.
I agree with you.
And so I actually like them when they're hovering a little on the softer side because you just get that full flavored earthy flavor from the potato. That's why a place like Jimmy's Red Hot did so well because some people could call them soggy. I totally get it. But you can't deny the flavor that's there.
And I think that's a great explanation, Nick. This has polarized the 21st office because we have some soggy fry lovers on the 21st staff. But we were having a conversation about this morning. This is why I actually really like Five Guys fries, which because I feel like as a chain, they consistently have fries that are crispy but somewhat soggy, but you can taste the potato. Louisa, I don't know how you feel. I don't know, you guys, I presume, Louisa, did you only do kind of independent places, or how did
exactly.
you yeah
that was another thing, was that we also then decided to do only small independent restaurants, maybe mini chains. Like Nick mentioned, there's small Cheval, but there's, you know, a few locations, but definitely did not do the bigger chains like Five Guys or Portillo's, which always gets a lot of controversy for us. But, you know, I'm very inclusive when it comes to style of fries. I'll take it crispy, crunchy, soggy. You know, there are some places that kind of have all of those textures in one basket. So, you know, I'm fine with all different kinds of fries.
So I wonder how much makes putting fries on sandwiches soggy. And when we talk about, for example, in Springfield, the horseshoe that either, I guess you have you can decide whether that celebrates or condemns fries, depending on how you look at it. Nick, what are your thoughts about the best fries you've had on a horseshoe?
So from what I know, I don't have extensive research for horseshoes in Springfield. I went down there last year for some corn dog research, but I did go out and my friend took me to Finley's Tap House, I believe. And he was very excited to show me them because they did fresh cut French fries for their horseshoe. And I know that a lot of places do frozen fries, which actually might work out better for the deluge of cheese sauce that goes on top.
But, right.
I cannot comment authoritatively on that subject. I will say that they're pretty delicious, even if I might not want to eat that too often.
Mike, do you have a thought on horseshoe fries?
We do a horseshoe as a special every once in a while, and people are always really excited about that. We use and our fries work out pretty well with that, with the cheese sauce.
And do you, what kind of cheese sauce do you use with your, because do you worry about, do you think about, is it going to be too saucy for the fries, or do you worry about that?
No, not too much. People love cheese. There probably can't be too much for
it's
most
kind
folks.
Of a lost cause, I feel like.
People also, Mike, people also love your sauce. We just got a Twitter comment that says, shoot that sweet Georgia peach sauce straight into my veins. So we know you've got a lot of fans for that. Can I ask you, Louisa, we're almost out of time, but Louisa, Nick, can you each name one more on the list that you really liked? Louisa, we want to start with you.
I really loved Illinois Bar and Grill, which was our number four pick. And they kind of had like a whole bunch of different kinds of styles of fries in one basket. And one thing that I really loved was that they almost came out to be like crunchy little clubs, like batons that I wanted to smack Nick over the head with when we were tasting them. Like, these are so good, you know, like, because they end up exploding at the ends and getting all like almost like you dip the ends in potato chips. And some get soggy, some get crispy, some get crunchy, all of it in one basket.
Nick?
Red Hot Ranch was our number two. And these are phenomenal fries. This is another thing that's just bizarre in Chicago, is they give you fries for free. So whenever you order like a hot dog or a Polish sausage, you'll get a bag of
So you automatically love them because
fries.
They're free. Yeah. I feel like that already gives it like 20 points.
And then they're just phenomenal. They're double fried. These are on a light, on a crispier side of the spectrum, if you enjoy that. But then the middle is the total mashed potato, almost more like the super butter-loaded mashed potato kind. And some of the fries stick to each other. So when you pick one up, you know, you might get three or four that come out with it. And they're just incredibly delicious.
Another comment we got to your fried twice. Marlene from Urbana told us on Facebook, the perfect fries are made with the right potatoes and are fried twice. Her favorites are Belgian fries with mayo, curry ketchup, and onions. Mike, is there a secret to the crispy fry? Anything that people should know?
Well, one of the things that when I read their article about was that a lot of these fries are fried in animal fat. A lot of times there's some beef tallow in there, and I wondered if they could speak to that just a little bit.
Louisa, Nick?
Oh, yeah.
Louisa, that's kind of...
Go ahead, Louisa.
That's actually kind of the default now. When you see places that have like the big brick of white fat that goes into the fryer, that's typically a mixture now of vegetable fat and then also animal fat. It's a touch of beef tallow, which is the rendered fat that comes from beef byproducts.
So I guess people who are vegetarian should ask if the fries are vegetarian, right, Louisa?
Well, technically. technically they're vegetarian. They're maybe not vegan, you know, as we know that vegetarian may not necessarily have an animal product, but so they may be considered vegetarian, but not vegan for sure.
Okay. Well,
but they lend this incredible meaty, or like this really weird meatiness to the fries that can make them, if you sort of think like a Sunday roast, when you have roast potatoes, maybe with your chicken or with a roast beef or something, that flavor is sort of what you get from these fries. And it's just amazing.
Thanks for that.
And weird means delicious. Weird means delicious for us.
That's
the way we describe food. Yeah.
You guys, we will tweet out the story. We'll have it up at 21stshow.org if you want to check out Nick and Louisa's list. Louisa Chu, Nick Kindlesberger from the Chicago Tribune. I want to thank Mike Cochran from Black Dog Smoke and Ale House in Champaign and Urbana for bringing all of these great sauces into us. Guys, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thanks for having me.
That does it for us today. You can always head to 21stshow.org for more information about us. It's a great place to find past shows as well. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Tomorrow we'll be talking about the power of video gambling in Illinois, particularly as lawmakers are thinking about some of that legislation as we near the end of session. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We'll see you back here tomorrow.